This is Scott Becker with the Scott Becker Private Equity Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Shion Carroll. Shion's a managing director with the DAC Group. Shion's a brilliant, brilliant investment banker, thinker, consultant, advisor, and thrilled to have him on today. Shion, can you take a moment to introduce yourself? Then I'll ask you a couple questions about what you see in the PE world today.
Scott, it's a delight to be with you. Thank you very much. I lead both healthy and distressed M&A transactions. I head up the Special Situations Group at DAC. This is a very busy and creative period for me. And just last week closed my second transaction in this COVID period. So an exciting time.
Now, if a client ends up in the Special Situations Group, is that a bad sign or a good sign, or does it really matter?
Normally, it would be a bad sign in most firms because it means that you're in distress. The advantage of having a group, a firm that does both, is that we are not limited to buyers only in the distressed area. We access all of the middle market. So, in effect, what we're doing is we're achieving a healthy M&A result even for a highly distressed business.
Well, fantastic. And you've talked to me or mentioned that you see two or so big contradictory trends with private equity funds. Talk to us about what those trends are.
When our children were small, we used to take them to a farm festival. And it was fascinating to see, amongst other things, of how a loom works, how they used to weave the tapestry. And I think that's what's going to happen now. There's the warp and the woof. The warp is these vertical threads that are kept in tremendous tension, and then across goes the woof, which is the horizontal threads. And PE investment is going to be woven on the warp and woof of the economy's loom. In terms of what is the tension, people say, every PE group says, we're open for business. Well, really, that isn't true. And what I did is, in preparation for this podcast, in addition to the PE firms that I normally deal with, I spoke on a no-names basis to some major PE firms. And the story of what is really going on is very different to what is being told as part of the party line. There are many PE groups that are just not active. Some were already, before COVID, were already concerned about the recession, and now many of them are nursing their wounds, performing portfolio triage. There are some who are active. Those who are active have a different approach than in the past. They are considering, to a far greater extent, downside mitigation. They're looking for a more battle-tested portfolio. So their lens is very different. It's not just about returns. It's also about how to mitigate losses. So what they're doing is there's much more scrutiny around revenue models and more focus on rates. And if you listen to those two things, those are the things that PE cannot control. So there's a shift in the focus. They're also very affected by lending. And remember, I'm talking about the middle market. When you talk about the really large deals, you have the syndicated market, which is dying for product. But when you get to middle market lending, it's much more of a mixed bag. Some of the lenders are bruised and are pulling back. Others are repricing, in part because they were originally priced too low.
Isn't it something where you look at these middle market lenders, where they're repricing, where they've had portfolio companies that have performed well, notwithstanding COVID, and yet they're still being repriced by the middle market lender? Doesn't that cause the portfolio company, the PFRL company, to want to hate the mid-market lender? What's your sense of that?
Absolutely. And the lenders are just taking the attitude they have to make up the losses that they're having in other parts of their portfolio. And they're also more risk averse. So PE doesn't have the confidence in the lenders that they used to do. And what a lot of the PE funds are now, they're putting in their own preferred stock into the deal, and they're expecting to refinance in 1 to 2 years.
And what's your sense of, you had mentioned that private equity funds are sort of triaging their portfolio. And I think I know exactly what you mean. They're looking at companies that have performed well that should be doubled down on, companies that are really struggling, that it's been a retail component or in-person component that may really be struggling. They got to figure out whether it's sustainable or not. And then they've got companies that are doing okay and trying to figure out, can these companies still add materially to our returns or not? How do you see the private equity funds looking at their portfolio companies that they've triaged?
They are having to prop up some of the weaker performers and work out ultimately what they are going to do with them. But this reduces, obviously, their attention to new opportunities and even to growth opportunities for the other portfolio companies. That, I think, is beginning to change now. It was very much, you know, like a MASH unit originally. But they are coming out of that mode.
No, you also mentioned, no, and I hear you, they're trying to clarify what they have in their portfolio, what's going on, some that were really in trouble, some that have done fine, and some that have done great. You mentioned the PE fund putting in additional capital, sometimes some preferred equity that'll come out before the rest of the equity, or recapitalizing, but not recapitalizing in the traditional sense where it takes money out through a great recapitalization, but recapitalizing through actually trying to prop the company up and make sure it's sustainable for the long term. Is there tension between the owners of the company and the management of the company and the private equity funds in these situations? How palpable is that tension?
There is some tension, obviously. But to a large extent, they have been in the same boat. Certainly at this point, there's more that binds them together than divides them. I think that's what's interesting is that with all of that is there's also the wolf. And that is the other side of the coin. If you don't mind, I'll go into that.
Please.
So this is what's interesting. I just told you the downside. But what I'm hearing from the PE firms that if you factor in the results, and obviously that's my key language. If you factor in the results, the expected COVID reset on pricing hasn't really occurred. The bottom line is there is plenty of money available. One of my mentors made a very interesting comment to me. He said, the low interest rates are the fuel for all of this. He said, the price of the fuel is so low that they filled up their cars, so they want to take the car out for a spin. The PE talks about they're looking for recession-proof deals, but they're just not enough of these deals. And that's why they're going to have to chase the same opportunities as their competitors. And that is the warp and the woof. You've got the tension of these vertical threads, but then going across, you've got the woof, which is you've got all of this money. You've got all of this money looking for a place, and they're all going to be chasing many of the same opportunities.
This is the great question. You're hit it exactly right. There is a crazy amount of money sitting on the sidelines that's ready to go. That, you know, it's estimated $2.1 trillion or some crazy amount with private equity funds. They at some point have to place that money someplace. So if they have to place that money someplace, there's only so many firms that are quote-unquote COVID-resistant and still in growth mode. What does that mean? Does that mean they should be scared for the long-term returns on that money that gets placed now because it just has to find a home or the private equity funds don't profit? What is your sense of should they be scared for the future?
Scott, you are asking exactly the question that PE should be facing. PE needs to focus on their models but also to go beyond modeling. They need to make a conscious determination about future human behavior. And I see that there are two opposing scenarios. And what I'd like to do, with your permission, is to present these two scenarios. The first scenario is captured in a very important paper that was delivered just a few weeks ago at the Jackson Hole Conference. It's called Scarring Body and Mind: The Long-Term Belief Scarring Effects of COVID-19 by Kozlowski, Feldkamp, and I'm going to mispronounce the last name, Venkata Sawaran. And what they argue is that people will be scarred. They'll be scarred from learning that pandemics are more likely than we previously thought they were. So what's going to happen, they say, is the effect after COVID is finished with, the negative effect on the economy is going to be a multiple of the negative effect from COVID, which is a staggering assertion which they model out in tremendous detail. They say without belief scarring, without this fear that will have been placed on the populace, investment will surge. But they say the memory of this passing event of COVID will be persistent. And for their modeling, this is how dramatic it is. They are assuming that COVID-19 is over by the end of 2020, which is a staggering assertion. But they say there will be long-term negative effects on the trajectory of the economy. I would suggest that P has to choose between that scenario and a very different scenario from a very different discipline. It really made me think of an essay by Robert Louis Stevenson in IS Triplex, where he writes ostensibly about death, but he's really writing about life. And he says, death stands alone in man's experience, I'm reading this, and has no parallel upon earth. Few things are spoken of with more fearful whisperings than this prospect of death. But here's the dramatic part. He says, few have less influence on conduct under healthy circumstances. What he argues is, and this is a fascinating concept, he says, we don't love life at all. Otherwise, we would never act. He says, what we love is living. So that would argue that there will be, at the end of COVID, there will be changes to consumer behavior, to investor behavior, but there will be a bounce back. What I think is, Scott, what you just raised is the ultimate question, and that's what PE should be focusing on, is saying, what do they think is going to happen to the consumer? Is it going to be a permanent scarring, in which case they have to really go for recession proof? Or do they say there's going to be a real bounce back? So I think what you just asked is the most important issue facing PE and our economy at the moment. What do you think?
Fascinating.
Let me ask you, Scott, what do you think is going to happen? If you had these two scenarios, the one is the scarring, and there's going to be a negative effect, and the other is there's going to be a psychological bounce back.
Right. I think there's two or three reference points on it. One is, I think memories are quite short. So even though there's a scarring, I even see amongst the population that when people really contain their spending habits in March and April and May because of being so scared, quickly as they saw things loosen up a little bit, their spending habits bounced back very quickly. So I think people have very, very short memories. The second thing that I think plays into a lot of things is debt. If people end up too indebted or government ends up too indebted, at some point you have to squeeze the money supply. There's no way around it. You can't keep on printing money without there being long-term consequences. Those can have an effect. It might lead to inflationary assets, so there's still great value in these PE portfolios and people that own assets, but ultimately it has a negative effect on people's actual economies and people's actual ability to live in a certain way. So you might have asset values going up, but not having real value created. That's the second issue. The third thing that I would say about the psychology of all this is somewhat based on, Malcolm Gladwell wrote about this, others have written about this, in England, at the start of World War II, they were so scared about being bombed so crazily that they built a ton of psychiatric hospitals. And what they found was the experience of being bombed and not actually being hit ever left people to feel very, very resilient. So the psychological impact was much, much less worse on Londoners and United Kingdom folks than expected. And in fact, they ended up being tremendously resilient because they found for all the scare, they mostly survived. And so what I don't know is you have two or three things. I think the psychology of all this will bounce back fairly quickly. The debt, however, will be for a very long time and will ultimately have a long-term overhang on the economy. But I think the psychological stuff for the average consumer, for most of us that don't live in a daily quantitative world, will bounce back quite quickly. It's just human nature. People go back to all their habits very quickly as things regress back to the norm. And I think that's likely to be the case. Now, whether you have inflation in assets and the private equity funds could play that well, it remains to be seen. That's certainly a possibility. So, but we'll see. I think it's a fascinating time. And, you know, as always, I'm quite conservative as an investor. The private equity funds always seem to do better than me because they're not a conservative and understand the game better than I do. So we'll have to see how it plays out, Shyam, but I think a great question.
But your psychological insight is not a conservative insight. Now, I'll tell you, I've bounced this question off a number of people. When it comes to people who are in business, they divide. When I spoke to, very interesting, a few mental health professionals, they all gave the same answer as you. They all said people are much more resilient, people bounce back, and there will be changes in behavior, but there will be bounce back, and they do not believe there will be the long-term scarring.
Scott, right. I've seen, I'll tell a story very quickly,
yes.
And I've seen this so much that I believe that it's reality. We had a very, very close friend, sold his business for a fortune, lost all that money, and then built another business, sold that for a fortune. And when he sold the next business for a fortune, you would have expected that this time he would have been so cautious about his assets and his money and everything else, because look, he had just had the experience of having lost everything before. Mm-hmm. And I see this constantly with people whose houses have gone into foreclosure, who ended up in financial trouble. They seem to forget fairly quickly and have short memories. This person went out and lived big again, didn't lose all his money, has done fine, but I could understand how it could happen. And it's amazing to me, sort of the psychology of short memories and a lot of this stuff. But go ahead, you were going to say something else. But it's a fascinating thing to watch in our world.
Look, what you have raised is what, and that's what one of the professional, he was a psychiatrist, brilliant man, said this is what happened after the Holocaust. He said some were scarred. Some of the people were scarred for life and couldn't operate. But he says as a group, the people who survived went and they started new families and they were very successful in business. They took chances, they rebuilt as a group, obviously. Obviously, the individuals who terribly scarred. What I'd like to do, Scott, if you don't mind, is to just leave people in PE with one very practical suggestion that they can implement, if that's all right.
Please.
Scott, you and I have just spoken about what I think is the ultimate question, but let me just give one tip that any PE firm can implement. Many more of the people who are going to be selling now are not people looking to cash out. There'll always be those. But many of my clients are not people looking to cash out. They are now trying to bring in enough capital to survive in what I call the economic reordering. What I would recommend to every PE group is concentrate on the human side. Think about the person selling and try to present a vision of how that person can find a home as a portfolio company and can be successful. PE firms do it to some extent. They wait pretty late in the sale process to try to present that vision. I would argue move it much further up so that you can differentiate yourself because you're all chasing the same deals. There are very few that are truly recession-proof, and put a lot more thought into that. Bottom line, step away from your financial model and think about people.
Well, fascinating thoughts this year, and always brilliant to visit with you. Always great thoughts. Love visiting with you. Thank you for joining the Scott Becker Private Equity Podcast. Just a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Scott.